Coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, resistance radio, and I like to say persistence radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today we have a stupendous show. It's all about shining light into shadows and understanding the darkness. We'll chat with historian Kirill Kunakovich on his book, The Long 1989 Decades of Global Revolution, about dictators, fascists, and nationalists. What is the appeal? And we have Kelly Fanto Dietz, expert on African-American history, foodways, and archaeology. She is the Director of Programming, Education, and Visitor Engagement at Stratford Hall in Montrose, Virginia. Nancy, are you there?
I'm here. I'm bringing my flashlight. I got my Klieg light. We're going to take all the darkness. Get it out of here.
Can we please?
Put it. Yeah, exactly. Yes, I'm here. I bet you don't know this, Ellen, because you're so busy getting us to be chatting at this moment, but even this morning, Mr. Wretched's neighborhood, someone else is stepping down. Did you know?
Oh, no.
Ryan Zinke.
No.
The Department of Interior man. I think it's by the end of the year. I think this blue wave is, of course, not the man in charge, but it made me wonder if, like, all these corrupt private jet setting, cabinet people, if anybody else who's on the list might step down before the Democrats get in and start investigating. But anyway,
he's jumping ship.
Leaving the neighborhood.
Well,
December.
Speaking of neighborhood, can we just talk about the Pelosi Schumer discussing the Trump government shutdown? And can I call it the man part wall? I love how Pelosi handled the toddler, Trump, and as he tried to, I would call it mansplain, of course, to her. She said, please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as a leader of the House Democrats who just won a big victory. And then the best part, a good part, was when she came out, she was, shown sliding on her sunglasses, wearing a jacket with a high funnel collar that people started asking for. So it turns out it's from the Italian fashion house Max Mara, and they announced it's bringing the coat back from 2013 in a range of colors, including Pelosi's rust shade, and it's called a fire coat. So I just love
fire coat.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
Fire
hey,
coat.
You know what? If Max Mara can bring back 2013, I would be in favor of that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that all sounds really good. I did see that coat online.
Yeah.
It always comes down to fashion and women, but I can't argue.
Well,
she looked amazing. She looked badass. It was very cool.
Yeah, that was just the crescendo or the final point.
Yeah.
In what
are they
in
coming out with a Pence recliner by chance? Can that guy hide in a piece of furniture?
I know. What was he doing there?
I don't know. He's our man, though. He's our next in line.
That's true.
If he's awake, that is.
It was like Pelosi even said she was being a mom. So it's like you have one child who's just like horrible, cranky and throwing tantrums, and then you have the quiet child just sitting there.
Yeah, no, she's very impressive, and naturally, the Republicans can't wait to get the Democrats to, fight amongst themselves about, well, she's so effective, maybe she should leave.
Yeah, well, I hope that they put that to rest because she's amazing.
You would think.
Yeah. So do you have any events you want to mention?
I do not. I only know of two guests. Those are my events.
Me too.
You already told us.
We could skip right to it. I just wanted to mention a fun event, January 18th here in Charlottesville. Paramount at the Movies presents Breakfast at Tiffany's. Another reason, another, you know, indication that we want to throw ourselves back to 1961 when it won an award. But, so, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Nance.
Okay. All right.
You're so quiet. All right, we have a fantastic
I'll probably go lightly my way over.
Anyway, so our first guest, we are so happy to have him back. He was here in the past. His name is Kirill Kunakovich. He's the assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. His expertise is modern Europe with a focus on Central and Eastern Europe in the 20th century. He's here to discuss his new book, which he co-edited, called The Long 1989, Decades of Global Revolution. So welcome to the show, Kirill.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So, you know, I'm tempted to say, how do you feel about 2016 and 17? It feels like a long 2016-17 as well.
It's an exciting time to be teaching. There's no question.
Yeah. So tell us, you know, what's the book report, or it doesn't have to be short, but your summary, what is your book all about?
So the starting point for this book was my co-editor, Pyotr Koshitsky, and I realizing how much people around the world were still talking about 1989, that this seems like an event that took place 30 years ago, and yet you see it on the streets in Ukraine and in Egypt and in China, and this remains a point of reference for protesters as well as the people trying to suppress them. And so the question we asked in this book was, why is that the case? Why does this event from so long ago still seem so relevant?
I must ask the question, what event are you talking about?
So 1989 was the year of the fall of communism across Eastern Europe, the year of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the year of peaceful social and political change in Poland and Hungary and Romania. And it also became a concept. 1989 became an idea of transformation, the ability of people to change the world and change their system. And so what this book does is it brings together scholars from seven countries. It looks at how the events of 1989 in Europe resonated across the world and how they remain current today. We make the argument that these revolutions are really ongoing. We should think about this as an ongoing global revolution 30 years in the making.
Are you didn't actually say this, but the way you answered makes me ask you, what is happening now? Should we try and remember that this doesn't have to be the last chapter that is that's what I'm hearing, but you didn't. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. I think in some ways that legacy of 1989 can be both encouraging and somewhat depressing, in the sense that what once seemed like a triumph of democracy and of people power was never so simple. And it's clear enough when we look back to the countries at the epicenter of the revolutions, at Eastern Germany, at Poland. What's happening there, once you have this tremendous explosion of people power, things don't just sail smoothly afterwards. On the other hand, I think it is a reminder that even at moments when no one sees it coming, and that was very much the case in Eastern Europe in 1989, the emergence of revolution is possible. And I think in terms of what it means for us, we should think about, and we do in this book, think about the conditions that made those events possible back in 1989 and to what extent those are still relevant today.
So can you set the stage? You mentioned no one saw that coming. For us who are not historians, mm-hmm. what was happening? Was it mm-hmm. what was happening?
So across Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union, there was a sense, just as in the West, that we were in the midst of an eternal Cold War, that there were all-powerful communist regimes that would never give up power, and that there were isolated groups of protesters who didn't really have much ability to do much. And what took people by surprise is just how quickly the entire system fell apart, that it certainly looked from the outside that people took to the streets and the walls crumbled. The Berlin Wall came down in November of 1989, and became this symbol of openness, freedom, democracy. And of course, the real story is more complex. There was a lot that took place behind the scenes. There was an awful lot of organizing that had to go into the kind of pictures that we ended up seeing. But the sense was that history was stable. And one of the lessons of 1989 is just a reminder of its instability and its contingency and of the speed with which things can change.
Do you think the any of the former Soviet republics are in are doing better than expected? What is your feeling about, you know, how those that have come to the light since the wall was disassembled?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I think I would have answered this differently 10 years ago when there was a sense that there was a kind of progression, right, away from communism towards democracy, that this was a more or less linear path, and that we could kind of track how far countries had come. And by those metrics, certainly Poland and Hungary would have been right at the forefront of countries that had moved away from communist regimes, that had carried out quite successful lustration, that is to say, cleansing campaigns, and had really integrated themselves into the European Union. But what we've seen over the past few years is that this is not a linear story. What we're talking about is not a simple progression from dictatorship to democracy, and that the nature of democracy is always contested. And Poland and Hungary offer the best examples. I think in many ways they've overcome the communist legacy, but now they deal with the same problems that all of us do. And those problems are inherent in democratic institutions.
Yeah, it seems like even, like, you know, as you said, I mean, nothing is a straight line. And it's very unnerving to me anyway to see, like, the instability, at least at the moment, in France. And I just, you know, you oddly count on Germany to be the bedrock, and Merkel's not running for re-election. I'm just like, gosh, anything, you know, can we get to 2020 soon enough, you know?
Well, I think it's in that light that thinking about 1989 maybe does offer some hope, you know, the way in which things change quickly, but also the way in which long-running and seemingly minor efforts can really pay off. So to go back to the example of East Germany, you know, the Berlin Wall, we remember the crowds that gathered there in November, but those crowds really started building 10 years before at small church services in Leipzig. And for a while, it was 5 people, 10 people. They would come once a week. They would sing and say prayers, and they would just gather to be together, to build up what they called a civil society, just being people in the world acting the way they wanted to act, acting as if they were free. And for a decade, it seemed like this was just this quixotic, esoteric, selfish activity going nowhere. But it was absolutely instrumental once more people started to look for alternatives, once frustration started to mount. People looked for somewhere to go, looked for some kind of structure to hang on to, and those little church gatherings helped create and fortify and unite this enormous popular protest. So if we think about how long 2016, 2017, 2018 have all been, I think it's the little things that we can do day by day that don't seem like they add up to much that really become the foundation for something quite major.
That's really important. Thank you. I don't know how often we have a historian or someone, a scholar, speaking to those kinds of things. So it's great that history is backing that up. So what is it? What is the appeal to people about fascism and authoritarianism?
There's lots of appeals. You know, one of the depressing discoveries, I suppose, or reminders of reading texts of people living under fascism, under authoritarian regimes, is just how popular they are. For most people at most times, these are very comfortable, very comforting, very safe spaces, partly because they make life easy. All of the hard work that I've just described, right? All the hard work of having to show up once a week, of having to make connections for any of us who've worked in campaigns, having to knock on doors and get voters out. That's hard, right? And it's a lot easier to say, well, they know what they're doing. We are in safe hands. We are being protected. We don't have to go out of our way. We don't have to make an effort. That sense of comfort and detachment from the political process, in the abstract, maybe that sounds scary, but it can feel awfully pleasant and awfully satisfying.
why is it that, why does nationalism, seems to me, take on, why does it go dark? Why does it usually get used in, why is it just such an appealing device for authoritarian regimes or countries or whatever, you know, that rule?
Right. It's a really interesting question because the whole predominance of nationalism is so fascinating from a historical perspective, starting with the basic fact that it's actually very recent, right? Through the first years of the 20th century, the vast majority of Europeans would never have thought of themselves in national terms. They wouldn't say we are Germans or Italians. They would say we are Romans or Catholics or workers. And it's only been within the past century that this idea has taken root. And it's now seemingly inevitable. It just seems so foundational to our identities, to ourselves. I think the uses of nationalism by authoritarian regimes have to do with a sense of community, have to do with a sense of building the notion of the people and of presenting themselves as the champions of the people. That's very much the case in Hungary today. For instance, the current Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, speaks proudly of the notion of illiberal democracy. He says, you know, we are not a country that will be divided by our differences, but we will come together as a nation. And that is beautiful rhetoric and, again, comforting and appealing, but, of course, horrifying in its implementations. What it means is individuals don't have rights and the people, as an abstract concept, as represented and expressed and interpreted by the government, really trample over all else.
Do you see the similarities? Are you surprised at how similar we are behaving to all those countries that you studied for on the other side of the ocean? Is this surprising to you how we're not far behind right now?
I think, to be honest, I think it has been. It probably shouldn't be. I should be smarter about this. But it took me aback when I started seeing far more resonances, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And I also started seeing a lot more students in my classes, right? All of these topics that seemed so abstract and distant and hypothetical suddenly became very real and concrete. And, you know, my friend and colleague Tim Snyder, who wrote a really interesting book about lessons of history, lessons of the 20th century, had a little throwaway line in it. He said, you know, for a long time, historians had talked about a gradient in European history, that ideas, concepts originated in the West and then spread east. The Industrial Revolution is kind of a perfect case of that. And he said, now this gradient seems to be reversed. Things are coming to us from the East. And so the terrifying thing is, I do think Poland and Hungary are not only reminiscent of what we're seeing, but may offer a kind of glimpse of our future, at least a future, a possible future. And that is very scary.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Kirill Kunakovich. We're going to be right back with more. We're going to hear about his class, Life in Dictatorships. Also, we have Kelly Fanto-Dietz, Director of Programming, Education, and Visitor Engagement at Stratford Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So Kirill Kunakovich, assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. I wanted to ask you about what's going on currently in Hungary. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned a minute ago, I think we should be paying attention to this because some of the events and processes that we're seeing in Hungary may be ours soon as well. And they're pretty scary. One of them will be familiar to listeners in the U.S. Viktor Orban's regime has really led an assault on the judicial system and on the courts, both by staffing courts with his handpicked people and also by creating, the most recent development is creating a separate branch of administrative courts to handle affairs of state. And the regime has said this is a purely procedural distinction, but what it means is that a new set of courts with a new set of regime-friendly judges will be in charge of things like elections. And this is, in fact, a very common tactic of authoritarian regimes, not to break the rules of the game, but to change the rules of the game. If you can change the way elections work, you don't have to rig them. You don't have to fool people. You simply follow the law as it becomes, and it delivers you victory. And that's very much what Orban has in mind. And, of course, we've been hearing an awful lot about electoral law in our country, too. Similar development.
Yeah, I mean,
sorry, I don't... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, just this morning, I think it happened last night, that one of, you know, Trump's appointed judges has now thrown in the latest monkey wrench, which is underplaying the Obamacare is now going to, you know, has to go back to the courts because another, you know, this one right-wing appointed judge is, this is not exactly what you're talking about, Carol, but it is somehow, you know, the executive branch taking control to this extent to undermine what the people want. I'm sorry. Please continue your train of thought. It was better than this.
No. This is, I think, an apt point to bring up. I do want to emphasize that I think the way our court system works is, at least for now, quite different from Hungary. And as we encountered with President Trump's statement about Obama judges, I think we should be cautious in distinguishing between conservative liberal judges, or at least assuming that that represents a breakdown of order. But what power courts have is massive. And what makes that power so dramatic is how hard it is for ordinary people to resist, right? One of the most effective techniques that authoritarian states have is to bury really important changes in procedural legislation, in minor regulatory shifts, things that are very hard to get fired up over, right? It's hard to get people into the streets saying, we demand a slightly different structure to the court system. Mm-hmm. And that makes it a very easy and very effective target for slipping in substantive, really transformative changes one step at a time.
Well, here's a better example, actually. Like, for instance, just because they have us on the streets or, you know, calling our senators and Congress people daily, what just happened officially anyway in Wisconsin, I believe that was just yesterday that Scott Walker did sign that bill, that we don't really care what the election results are. We know better, or even if we don't know better, we're doing it our way, and we're going to strip all the power of these people coming in that you voted for. Ha-ha. You know, like, just watching democracy in small ways, or in large ways, if you're living in Wisconsin. It's very unnerving to think about your country, you know, getting just picked apart in all these loopholes or weaknesses we have in the Constitution.
And I think the rationale for making changes like that touches back on this concept of nationalism, but really on the concept of the people, right? The rationale for making electoral changes, whether here or in Hungary, is precisely that elected officials represent the people as a concept. And that's a concept that, again, can resonate and create great sound bites and be very believable and persuasive, but is also immensely dangerous. Once you start talking about the people rather than people, things become very shady.
I believe it's happening in Michigan as well, Nancy. Some of that, the same kind of picking apart of or overthrowing what the people voted for in favor of whoever's in power now. I wanted to just to turn a little bit to your class, because I wanted to talk about the influence your class is having on your students. It's called Life in Dictatorships, correct?
Yes. So we in the Corcoran Department of History get to teach these first-year seminars that are small classes aimed at first- and second-year students, so people just coming to the university, fresh and bright-eyed and really excited to be there, which is wonderful for us to teach. But it's also an opportunity to talk about these weighty and important issues. At least that's was my thought process in teaching a course like this, Life in Dictatorships. I wanted to think about the experience of living under authoritarian regimes. And so the way this class is structured, we talk about three regimes, Nazi Germany, communist Eastern Europe, and Putin's Russia. And we read entirely first-person accounts of people who lived through them to get a feel for what is this really like? You know, what is the texture of life in a dictatorial regime, and what can we learn from it? Of course, the whole class is inspired by the present moment. It's inspired by our civic duty. And some of the conclusions, I think, connect awfully well to what we've talked about so far, terrifyingly well in some cases. But Nancy, to your point about seeing this happen around us, what really struck me in going back to some of these texts is that most of them start out with effectively the same story. It's people who say, one day I woke up and I realized that my whole world had changed. And I realized that I now lived in a dictatorial state. I didn't know it yesterday. No one told me. There wasn't a revolution. There wasn't a major takeover in the streets. But one day, all the norms of my life suddenly flipped, and I only belatedly came to see it. And that's a pattern that just pops up again and again, and I think offers a reminder for us to be watchful.
What so far, I think you said the class is relatively new. If you can't generalize, I get it. Has there been a reaction from students in general, what is the reaction to reading these accounts you're giving them in class?
Well, it's been so interesting for me to observe because these are the students who came of age in the age of Trump. They are 17, well, I suppose 18, 19 now. Their entire political life has been in this campaign cycle, if not in this presidency. And so what stands out is they are much more political than students I had encountered before. They're far more in tune and engaged with the political arena, and I think in many ways that's wonderful. One side effect of it is I was struck by the fact that so many of these students also imagine that everything is political, or at least politicized. And the way that manifests is a real skepticism for the possibility of objective truth, or rather for the value of objective truth. Because in reading this course and in talking to students about it, I was struck by their willingness to recognize different sides to every story, which is, of course, admirable in some ways, but also in their unwillingness to demand a solution. In other words, so many of them seem perfectly happy to agree that your politics will determine the way you see everything, and that's just how things are. And I do think that's a product of the environment we live in and the product of a certain right-wing media offensive.
How good are they at listening to each other when talking about these things?
I think they are very mindful of the need not to offend each other. They are somewhat circumspect in talking about current events and very immediate political issues. One of the joys of having a small class like this is you can get students to open up and to build up a dialogue. And when you have 14 weeks of 15 students, you can get into real depth. Of course, that doesn't happen on the first day or the second day. And so I think there is an encouraging sign there that there is a dialogue that's possible, that is important, that is being had. But again, there is a lot of work that goes into trying to put it together. There's a fancy term for this, anticipatory compliance. In other words, obeying, doing things before you really have to. And my favorite part of the course was getting to read very smart, very sensible people who were deeply skeptical of Nazism and communism. At the same time, finding themselves, unbeknownst to them, going along with these states, saying and doing things that they had never imagined without being forced to do so just because that seemed like the thing to do. And that is the most chilling kind of account to read. And I realize, I think I have a much greater appreciation now for how hard it is to resist, right? To stand apart. That's, especially when the stakes get higher, that's a very tough ask.
Wow. Chilling is a really good word to, like, you know, to describe this. I wish we had a psychologist also to chime in, you know, do a multidisciplinary analysis of what happens. You know, maybe it's the cognitive dissonance and whatnot that make people just want to, and part our nature as we've evolved just to be like everyone else. It's really...
What do you think about the fact that there is, in terms of us, in terms of not Europe, that this administration does so much, you know, that there wasn't just one, that, what about the chaos, I guess? What does, is that like somehow obviously working against us, but working for their longevity, the fact they're still in power?
I think this is, you know, a question that, as a the historian to me wants to say, I can tell you in 30 years, right? Once the archives open, we will know better.
Fair enough.
But the citizen in me wants to say that one of the lessons, I think, from this course and from reading these accounts is that the solutions to the challenge of dictatorship, the resistance to dictatorship, is rarely political and much more often civic. And that at least the starting point is not necessarily in overcoming the power of dictators in the political arena. It's not voting them out. It's not restricting them. It's wonderful if you can do that. I think, I very much hope that we are still in a world where we can do that. But more important than that political sphere is the civic sphere, because it's in the civic sphere that we establish the foundations for resistance, that we establish the foundations for the maintenance of truth, for the preservation of community. And the thinker that really inspires me here, one of the authors we read in this class, is Václav Havel, Czechoslovak dissident, future president of the Czech Republic, who wrote very movingly about the concept of living in truth. He said, you know, I lived in a communist regime. I knew that I couldn't resist. If you go out on the street and protest, you are signing a death sentence. What you have to do in a regime like that is live in truth, which is to say, live as if you are free, behave how you would want to behave as a human being, as a citizen. Don't think about them. Don't think about all the challenges and oppressions that surround you, even if you can't make a difference. Even if you don't feel like you can make a difference on the big level, make a difference on the small level, because the way that authoritarianism works is not by oppressing you, but it's by getting you to oppress yourself. Mm. It's by limiting what you think is possible and by changing your behavior. And so the way to fight back at the most fundamental level is by harnessing the power you have within you to change your daily behaviors, to change how you think and respond. And that becomes the foundation for civic action and for the kind of protest that we saw on the streets of Berlin in 1989.
Well, it's a great way to wrap it up, and very interesting. That's Kirill Konakovich. His book is The Long 1989, Decades of Global Revolution. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yes. So in a few minutes, we're going to talk to Kelly Fonto-Dietz. But right now, we have a news of note. Nancy, would you like to start?
Well, I am looking at the clock, Ellen, and I think you should do yours, and unless you're not ready. I think you should do yours.
Okay, so a quick one. I wanted to say a little bit of good news is that on Wednesday, the Senate voted 50-49 to repeal the Trump Treasury rule that allowed dark money political nonprofits to withhold donor names from the IRS. So now we have a little more transparency. So speaking of, you know, the wealthy few who try to buy the elections and take away the power of the others. So on that note.
That's a good note.
That's a good note. Okay. So Kelly Fonto-Dietz is here with us. What's that?
Hello.
Hello. So she is the newly appointed Director of Programming, Education, and Visitor Engagement at Stratford Hall, the home of Robert E. Lee for a short time. It is located in Virginia's Northern Neck. She's a scholar and author of the critically acclaimed book, Bound to the Fire, How Virginia's Enslaved Cooks Helped Invent American Cuisine. Her specializations include African-American history, culture, and foodways, and historical archaeology, and so much more. So welcome again. Welcome back to the show, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So tell us what your job is there at Stratford Hall.
Yeah, there's a lot of hats that I wear up at Stratford Hall, which is a very powerful place. And I invite everybody listening to email me and I will give you a private tour. So just putting that out there right now.
Wow.
So yeah, hosts included. So my job is a lot of different things. You know, my title, I think, says a little bit about what I do, but the main thing that I'm focusing on, and I started this position in June of this year, the main thing that I've been focusing on is doing the research and telling the stories of the enslaved community at Stratford Hall. So Stratford Hall was built by enslaved laborers in 1738, and it was home to four generations of the Lees. And that story, in that context, has been told without the enslaved laborer part for decades. The Robert E. Lee Memorial Foundation purchased the property about 90 years ago, and the whole focus of the organization that owns it, the nonprofit, is to tell the history of the Lees and to preserve Robert E. Lee's legacy. Having me come on board has changed the script a little bit. We have a phenomenal archive. We have all of the letters and documents from all the generations of the Lees, and within that we have detailed information about the enslaved community who literally built and maintained the property. So I am bringing those stories, those people out of the archive, out of the shadows, and into the public arena. I am doing all sorts of things. I have produced an audio tour in the last 6 months, which is predominantly African-American voices, and that's something I'm very proud of. And what I want to say about that is that, you know, one of the things, I'm a public historian, one of the things that you have to do when you work with the public and you work in landscape and places is you have to what they call people the place. So when you walk through a historical landscape, when you walk through a plantation and you people that place, you find that the majority of the voices are going to be that of enslaved African and African-Americans. And so the audio tour people's the place, and all 28 stops have a story about who would have been in that place, what you would have seen, and no shocker there, but the majority of those stops are going to be about Black history and about not only that, but how the enslaved people in that space maintained the plantation, survived, persevered, and had very close relationships with some of the Lee family members.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, much, much more with fantastic Kelly Dietz. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. My co-host is Nancy Lawrence in New York City. I'm Ellen Daniels in Charlottesville, and we are here with Kelly Fanto Dietz. So, Kelly, we're talking about Stratford Hall. What have you discovered since being there? What are some surprises, or what have you found out?
So I'm also an archaeologist, so I'll start first with the archaeology stuff that I've been sort of digging through, and then I'll get into the archives and the stories that I found about particular and very specific moments and people out at Stratford. But one of the things that I've been really enjoying doing is it was probably about two or three decades worth of archaeology that was done out there by Mary Washington University under the directorship of Professor Doug Samford, who's recently retired from Mary Washington. Within that, very quickly, we found some West African waste beads, some glass handmade beads from West Africa that very likely traveled over on the Middle Passage on a woman and ended up in the ground. And that's a wonderful sort of, a token of this woman's life. And it helps tell that story in a textural way, which I think is really important. Another phenomenal artifact. And I have to say, we are only beginning to look at these artifacts. So I am so excited to see what's going to come forth. But one of the other artifacts that we uncovered is a tortoise shell and sterling silver hookah mouthpiece. And this is a spectacular artifact by itself, but it really speaks to what was happening in this Atlantic world space. We know that we had several enslaved West Africans from the Senegambia region. We also know that those enslaved Africans were Muslim. And, you know, what I would like to think happened with this piece is this came over from that area of West Africa and was brought over from a culture that was a little bit different than the culture you would find, say, in the Congo or the other areas of West and Central Africa that were bringing enslaved folks over. But it tells the story of the Muslims that were here in the 18th century. And it really sort of complicates this notion of integration and you know, the 21st century, and it really speaks to the fact that Muslims have been here since the very beginning of this country, and that they literally built it. We have records of a man named Osman, who was Muslim, enslaved African, who literally, he was building a ship at Stratford Hall that was going to go to West Africa to carry over possibly some of his family members, other enslaved and captured Africans, and bring them to Virginia. And just, you know, the sort of emotion that, you know, and sentimentality that is brought with that story. You have this object, you have a name, you have this known record in the archive of a slave ship or a trading ship, which was absolutely, you know, shipping tobacco and bonded people through the Atlantic. But you have these artifacts and these stories coming together to really bring a richness to not only the people who built this country and who lived at Stratford and who were forced to build and labor for the Lees, but the sort of diversity religiously that we also had in the early years. We've also found some other wonderful stories to tell, and I mean wonderful not in the sense of joyous because they were enslaved, but shedding light on these stories. When you spend hundreds of years not talking about the enslaved people who built this country, giving them voice through the records is something that I find incredibly powerful, and it drives my work and it drives my life. But we know about a man named Congo, C-O-N-G-O. I don't know if he was from the Congo, where that name came from, but he was a teenager and he was one of the men who built Stratford Hall. So when you go to a lecture, you see a photograph of Stratford Hall. It's this big, gorgeous 18th century mansion, knowing that enslaved Africans and Congo himself laid those bricks, you know, brought the clay to the kiln, you know, actually worked on the plaster inside of the home as well. It gives a sense of pride to that labor. You know, visiting these sites is something that's very emotional. It's very hard, especially if you're of African descent, and to sort of look at something like Stratford Hall and the building itself and look at it the same way that you would look at a pyramid or something that, you know, very historically has evoked a sense of pride, I think is something really important that we need to do more of in Virginia and throughout the states.
You know, being that you are only recently have gotten there, I realize this is the part of history that is your specialty, but knowing you've already said, like, there's just decades or hundreds of bags of artifacts, it sounds like you're going to be like constantly re-upping this audio tour or the way you present the story even of Stratford Hall with the more you uncover, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the fun part of it. You know, I could have waited until I finished all the research, which would take decades, but I don't work like that. I like to get things out as soon as possible, and I like to change the narrative as quickly as I possibly can. And so, you know, absolutely. I mean, just the stuff that we just uncovered, you know, what do I do with that? I'm not going to put it in the audio tour, but the docents, the interpreters are going to start talking about it. I'm going to also have a series of exhibits, both online and in the actual building in the visitor center, that's going to start telling the stories of these enslaved African Americans. And there's lots of different ways to get this information out. One of the things that I'm really excited about doing, so I've been there for about 7 months. And one of the challenges of working in public history is you have different generations of storytellers, different generations of narratives that are told, and you've got I have a staff of over 20 people who are docents, who tell the story of the Lees, and a lot of them have been there for 40 years. And to get them a lot of them are in their 70s and 80s, to start talking about slavery, they want to do it, but they don't know anything about it. It was never talked about in their grade school. They didn't learn anything about it in college, and they surely haven't learned anything in the last 30 to 40 years working at Stratford Hall. So one of the things that I'm starting in January is a series of workshops. I'm going to have guest lecturers come in. I'm going to lecture myself. I'm going to bring the docents into the archive and have them touch the records of the enslaved people, to read the names and the dollar worth of every single person that was enslaved there, and to get them as passionate and as excited and as engaged I am with this material. So when they give a tour, they can talk about Bobby Lee, but they are going to be talking about Caesar, about Nat, about Mary, and telling the whole story of Stratford Hall and not just that of the white men that lived there.
Can you tell one of those stories for us, one of the more interesting that you'd like to share?
Oh, absolutely. I've got two off the top, or three. Yeah, I've got some good ones. I got some good ones. You have to go up and check out the tour yourself, but, mm-hmm. and the tour, I have to say, has ambient sounds and first person narration, and it's a really fun, exciting, all sensory experience. But I'll start out with, let's see, where do I even begin? There's a man named Sonny. I'm going to start out with him because I love his, sort of rebellious spirit. He was, excuse me, Philip Ludwell Lee's manservant. And Philip Ludwell Lee was the, quote, master enslaver out at Stratford Hall in the middle of the 18th century. And he was a very flamboyant man. He liked to have trumpets, French horns being played on his carriage when he arrived places. And he was a very eccentric guy. And he had this man who he enslaved named Sonny, who just really couldn't handle him. And from all accounts, Philip Ludwell Lee was quite the personality. And I love this story because Sonny, I think, got to a point where he was just really getting fed up with the ego and the sort of, diva-ness that this Philip Ludwell Lee was always showing off. And, you know, dining during this period, food was so central to showing off your wealth. And if you want to know more about that, read my book. But Philip Ludwell Lee liked to have these grand dinners. And Sonny decided one day, and he was also the waiter, that he was going to come in and he was going to have dirty clothes on. And he buttoned his vest and he took his shirt tails out and he walked up to wait on Philip Ludwell Lee and his, prestigious guests looking like he had been rolling around in the dirt. And he did so with his head up high. He sat in the back and smoked a pipe and made Philip Ludwell Lee so incredibly angry that he wrote about this incident to his sister right after it happened. So there's little things like this where you see these moments of these enslaved folks who are, risking everything. I mean, Sonny was beaten after this. And that's something that, to risk being beaten, to be killed, to be, being sold, just to humiliate your master enslaver is something that I think happened more often than we realized. And it's something that I think is worth mentioning because every single moment of these enslaved people's lives were sort of built into waiting hand and foot on the Lee family. And at some point, you got to be fed up. And Sonny was fed up. And shortly after he was beaten, he ran away. And I hope that he had a better life after he left. I'd like to think that maybe he joined the British forces or who knows, this was right in the early 1770s. So it's his stories and others that really bring a kind of character to these people that worked and labored their whole life there. And there's also Caesar, who was a chef. And we have one of three chocolate stones in the colony. So we were making chocolate at Stratford Hall. I wasn't making chocolate. They were making chocolate at Stratford Hall. And again, there were three chocolate stones in the colonial Chesapeake area during the 18th century. And we had one at Stratford. So, the idea of this man, Caesar, who was the chef making all the food, also making chocolate, possibly selling it, is a story that we're going to be telling at Stratford. Again, talking about his skill and also the pain and the horrors of being an enslaved chef, which again, ties into my book, which you should probably check out.
I was going to ask you about how the book ties into your work there. We've heard a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my book is, Bound to the Fire, How Virginia's Enslaved Cooks Helped Invent American Cuisine. And the purpose of my book, and I think the point of my book, is to really put enslaved chefs not only sort of in the conversation about what it was like to have, to have been enslaved on a Virginia plantation or in the South generally, but to talk about their skill set and how they really used their skills, their knowledge, that they were talented, that they were trained, and that they had a little bit of soft power and their relationship with their enslavers because they could poison them and they could ruin a dinner. Of course, there were always risks associated with these kinds of things. But, their centrality in colonial Virginia is unmistakable. They were the ones cooking all of the food that made Virginia famous for its cuisine. And they were the ones that made people's homes talked about throughout the colonies. And when I first went to Stratford Hall, it was about 2 years ago, I gave a talk on my book that hadn't come out yet. And I gave a talk on my book, and I got to walk through the landscape. And the power of Stratford is something that you have to go and feel for yourself. There's a gravity there that I've never felt. But there is more square footage in that house dedicated to cooking and entertaining than any other home in Virginia. And there are two kitchens. The kitchen itself that Caesar would have cooked in is all decked out. You can still use it. We've got programs going on there all the time. But, my work with enslaved cooks, and their narratives ties in really well with a public history site, because most people that come to public history sites, especially somewhere like Stratford that is very much wedded to the Lee family, don't go there to learn about slavery. But through conversations about food, through conversations about landscape, about dining, about any of the buildings that are on site, you're able to insert those stories with integrity and remember all the people that live there in a more holistic way.
So perfect you want, you know, I'm sure there are other places I could use as an example, but it is so perfect that you wound up now bringing some, shedding light on the enslaved story of Stratford, considering that was such a, you know, a touchstone for you in writing your book on enslaved cooks, you know, that helped invent American cuisine. It's
Yeah, no, absolutely. I couldn't be more delighted to be working there. And the staff, I mean, everyone, the board, you know, people always ask, you know, oh, you work first at Stratford Hall. What's that like? You know, my paycheck is from the Robert E. Lee Memorial Association. And I have to say that they have been completely supportive of the work that I'm doing. And it's been an incredible experience so far.
Yeah, Michael Twitty, who has a little bit of fame, commented on your book that you said it's puts a powerful analysis of the lives of those ancestors whose hands stirred the pots in sorrow's kitchen. So, I mean, you have such enthusiasm about this, and at the same time, recognizing what was really going on behind the scenes. Not behind the scenes, actually, but
front stage in so many ways, right?
Front stage, but for us, for a lot of people who never learned, as you mentioned, never learned what really went on.
Right.
It's amazing you've already, you know, already sort of altered what the experience, well, sounds like from what you're saying, you're already altering the experience of someone that spends the day at Stratford Hall. What is the message you want people to get after spending a day at Stratford Hall?
I would like them to understand that enslaved laborers, that Africans and African Americans built this country, that their legacy is something that needs to be respected, acknowledged, and understood by every single American and everybody visiting a site throughout the states. And to understand that, you know, all of these people live together, that when you walk into the bedroom, the main bedchamber where Robert E. Lee was born, which is where the tour ends, that he was very likely delivered by an enslaved midwife. He was very likely nursed by an enslaved woman. And those kinds of relationships were commonplace during slavery. And it's about time that we start talking and acknowledging the fact that without slavery, without enslaved laborers who were forced to come here and work for generations, this country would not be what it is today.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being here. We could talk to both of you all day. So you'll come back. Hopefully three is a charm. Today was charming, actually, as well. I just wanted to thank you. I would say the second theme would be erudite and delightful. Thank you for bringing such passion, both of you, to and your scholarship to such really important topics. And we really need that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stick around because we want to take a picture. Don't leave. Hey, Nancy. Palate cleanser. You go first.
Let's shed a light on the cleansing of the palate.
Gotta make it.
Okay, I got one.
Do it.
A chemist, a rabbi, and a pickle company, and a brand of soda did not walk into a bar, but they did kickstart making American supermarkets more inclusive, in this case, more kosher. Heinz and Coca-Cola were unintentionally, because it was all about the bottom line, but they unintentionally set the precedent for supermarkets just carrying kosher products. And it began in 1927. There was a New York City chemist named Abraham Goldstein who approached Heinz because apparently Heinz, though born an American, had German immigrant parents who sympathized with European, the experience of coming here and navigating American culture. So he was into making his pickles and all that stuff suitable so that you know, kosher people could go to the supermarket, speaking of the Industrial Revolution, using the supermarket like everyone else. And then Rabbi Tobias Geffen also walked into Coca-Cola now that this had started in 1935, and he was one of the few who learned the secret formula, and that's how Coca-Cola got kosher.
Thank you.
Sure.
So mine quickly is, there is a third gender that is very recognized and accepted in Oaxaca, Mexico. They're known as Muxes, spelled M-U-X-E-S. They fill a unique role within the community, helping with the domestic chores for women there, and they're very respected because they're more of a social gender than a sexual one, and it's fascinating. There's some documentaries on it, National Geographic and the BBC.com. And actually, to picture them, if you think of Frida Kahlo, her look, they actually were given credit for inspiring her richly embroidered outfits. That's kind of what they look like. So thanks for tuning in to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Thanks, Nance. Thanks, our guests.
Yep.
See you next time. Our music is by Springtide.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something, brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.